If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Today's guest opens up about a subject that is incredibly taboo, incredibly fascinating, and very controversial. That guest also happens to be my aunt, Judith. Judith Bishop spent her career as a midwife, helping bring countless babies into the world, including my own daughter, Wyatt. When she retired, she was not done helping families. Now she helps them in a completely different way. She volunteers to aid individuals who are terminally ill with ending their life through assisted suicide. It is a legal practice, although not legal everywhere. Brittany Maynard, a young woman, brought the difficult subject matter to the forefront when she was diagnosed with terminal cancer and decided it was the right decision for her and for her family. The country followed her story as she was forced to move to Oregon in order to do it legally. Judith brings humanity to this very hot button issue, allowing us behind the scenes to look at the doctors and patients behind the headlines. Some might not agree with what she does or those who choose to do it, but it's an incredible story worth listening to and worth learning from. I really hope you give this a chance. I know it might be a topic that some people are really against even listening to the details from, but it's highly misunderstood and one I think you are going to benefit from listening to. So sit back, relax, and listen to Judith Bishop.
So hi, Judith. Thank you for joining me. I'm so excited you're here.
Me too.
So people don't know this, but you are my aunt and you delivered my daughter, Wyatt. You are my midwife in San Francisco. And I always get confused about whether or not I call you a doctor or not, because I think it's not really understood the fact that somebody could be a midwife, but kind of represent themselves as a doctor, almost. You did all the same things that I would have expected from care from a doctor. We were in a hospital. We never did anything like in a pool, in my house, naked, you know, did all these weird things.
The naked part.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of naked, but explain to people the difference between a midwife and a doctor and the credentials, but also, you know, what they do that's different.
Yeah. So in this country, all licensed midwives, the main path to becoming a midwife is through nursing. So the most common route is that you become an RN, a nurse, and then you do graduate training in midwifery. So it's more people now, I think, are familiar with things like nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. It's more at that sort of level. In a way, what we are is the experts in normal. The things that I don't do or didn't do are, for example, cesarean sections. Mm-hmm. So if everything's normal, a midwife is really the expert in that. Mm-hmm. And then when things start to look more complicated or get into territory where someone might need surgery, that's when you have an arrangement with a physician. Just like one physician might send a patient to a specialist, this is like sending you to a specialist. So on the same floor where you were having your baby, there were many doctors, many nurses, many pediatricians, many obstetricians, all a push button away.
Right.
But the thing is, you don't want them if you don't need them. Because that's when you start getting into, you know, doing more than you need to do. So I think that's one of the things people like about midwives is that if things are going fine, things stay kind of normal and low key. And
yeah.
Anyway. So,
and your history, I was talking about a little bit before, but explain to people how you got into the job that you did for a while.
How I became a midwife? Mm-hmm. Well, it was pretty random, and it was the times. I think it was the 70s. It's when women's health was sort of becoming an issue, and women taking care of women and our bodies, ourselves, and birth control and abortion reform, and all of that was happening. And I was involved in all of that, but I had a pretty basic liberal arts education. So when I graduated from college, I really just couldn't find where to plug myself in. And I seemed overeducated or undereducated for most jobs I was looking at. One day, my very good friend told me that her mother had been a nurse practitioner. She must have been one of the first nurse practitioners after it became a thing. I had never heard of it. And then she also said, you know, there's such a thing as a midwife. And I just thought it sounded like a wonderful idea. The other thing is that, you know, there I was, a woman in my childbearing years. And it's a kind of a way to, you know, it's all about you. It's learning and being able to do stuff that was relevant to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably going to say the same thing about the topic we're discussing today. But I just thought, what could be more wonderful? And I turned out to be right.
Ah, that's great. So, but like for doctors or residents that are going on a path to go into obstetrics, don't they have to have years of residency and kind of learn how to do this for many years? Like, what's the difference between what you had to do? How'd you get so good at it, I guess, is my real question.
Well, a lot of it is experience. And so, you know, you do learn as you go along. But you're right that for doctors, they do medical school, they do residency, then they sometimes do a fellowship and a specialty. This is a much shorter thing, but it's a much narrower thing. So I didn't need to learn all the complications. I needed to know the signs of normal and not normal. In my job at the university, I taught residents and medical students. We were really an integral part of the teaching program for doctors. And the reason was, for the reason I mentioned, is that we were the experts in normal, and they needed to learn that before they went on to learn the rest of it.
Yeah.
So yes, the doctor training is longer by a number of years, but you know, during part of that time, they're gaining experience. And I guess you could say some of my experience was on the job.
So, and you have the perfect personality for this kind of job. You're calm. You're not somebody who's Heart rate goes up with stress. Usually you're soothing. And that was the experience that I had with you as my midwife. You, the whole time I was pregnant, it was all very calm, even though I wasn't calm, but you were, and made me feel calm. And those are 9-10 months that are stressful for people. And you don't know what your body's telling you, and you're very helpful. And then the when I had Wyatt, it was all somewhat normal, with the exception of the fact that it took me 24 hours. And, you know, it took me a while for my actual water to burst. And that was a whole fiasco. And then I felt, I think everyone was on a lunch break when I finally went into contractions, and I'm pressing my button. And
of course.
Yeah. I need an epidural immediately. And, at first I thought maybe I'd want to be a hero and not do that. But then as soon as I felt those pains, you know that you want it when you want it.
And it was perfect. It went perfectly, given that, you know, there's always some excitement, but that's the point. But
yes, exactly. And so what was it like for you bringing lives into the world?
You know, people would ask if it ever lost its wonder and its magic. And it never does. Each one is, you know, you get busy with the labor and with everything that's going on. And I'm as shocked as anybody when you look up and say, oh, it's a baby. You know, it's like you sort of forget what's happening. And then there it is. And it's just incredibly mind-blowingly wonderful. And also, it's a way of relating to people that I found very satisfying, which is you enter the most intimate moment of their lives. You never knew them particularly before. You're not maybe going to know them after, but for that one moment, you're all together bringing this little life into the world. And of course, Wyatt was the cutest baby ever. And, you know, it's just, you just are flooded with the sense of wonder. The wonder of it all, because it's pretty crazy when you get right down to it.
Yeah. So it doesn't get old after.
It never got old. Each time it was like, oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God, it's a baby.
Right. So how many years did you do this before you finally retired?
Almost 45, I think. Over 40. Yeah. Some time.
And you and I have talked about it, that when you retire, you know, you can't just go to doing laundry and going to lunches and go swimming. You need something else in your life. So now let's talk about, you know, why
we're here
today and what we're talking about. Tell me how you even got interested in the path that you're in now.
Well, I think, you know, in the same way that I was drawn to birth in my youth, that, you know, what competes with that in terms of you know, just an incredible life event. And of course, it's the other side of the coin, it's death. Yeah. And I had thought about that. And in fact, although most of what I did as a midwife involved, you know, happiness and joy, there were, of course, bad things that happened and people who died. And so I was aware that was the other side of the coin. And I remember thinking that I thought that would be a pretty interesting place to go if and when I had the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I think I told you that my husband, Bob, before I retired, as a physician, he had been working on getting an end-of-life law passed in California. And he was going to meetings and he was lobbying the legislature and all of that. So I was definitely aware that there was an attempt to get a law in California. And I was certainly felt supportive of the concept, but it wasn't until I retired that, and by the time I retired, there was a law. So then there was this gap of, oh, you've got a law, but how do people find out about it? How do people get educated about it? How do people access it? It turns out not to be that simple. And there was a newly formed organization after the law passed, a nonprofit volunteer, all volunteer organization that I now work with, that saw that as their mission to help move that law from being on a piece of paper to being something that people knew about and could take advantage of and access, actually.
So it's interesting because the people that I've mentioned this topic to as end of life laws, and they didn't even realize that there was 9 states in America that this was legal in. And am I right about that? Is it 9?
10.
10.
10 states and Washington, D.C.
Wow. Okay. And what do you know what the last one was with the most recent addition?
Yeah, the most recent were Maine and New Mexico.
Right.
But there have been a flurry of them. The oldest, the first was Oregon, and that was 26 years ago.
Yeah.
And then another 10 years, and then another in California was 2015, 2016, and we were like number 7.
Right. So when people talk about end-of-life options, I think a lot of people are stuck in the mentality of like, you know, the Dr. Death, the guy who was sort of being hired. Yeah, Kevorkian, who was being hired to, you know, help people with suicide and it wasn't legal. And so let's talk about the actual law. What are the, is the law the same in every state and it's a universal law, or is state by state, is it different?
This episode is brought to you by Rocket Money. Have you ever found subscriptions you forgot about or any you paid twice for and you didn't realize it? Guys, I'm so excited to bring you some information about Rocket Money. It's an app that you can have on your phone. It helps you monitor your subscriptions and things you might be spending money on that you have no idea or have forgotten about. I did this for myself. It took me less than 5 minutes to get all my information in there. And then all these screens came up showing me exactly what I spend on home goods, what I spend on beauty, what I spend on food. It broke it down by category. And then I saw the subscriptions. So not only does it give you a great way to budget yourself, monitor what you're spending money on, but the biggest difference is it helps you cancel a subscription that was otherwise tricky or time consuming. So Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and it helps you lower your bills all in one place. Most people think they're spending $80 on subscriptions when in reality, the number is closer to 200. When you're signed up for so many things like streaming services you used to watch, free trials for delivery you don't use, it's easy to lose track of what you're paying for. With Rocket Money, you can easily cancel the ones you don't want with just the press of a button. No more long hold times or annoying emails with customer service. Rocket Money does all the work for you. Rocket Money can even negotiate to lower your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is take a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money also lets you monitor all your expenses in one place, recommends custom budgets based on your past spending, and they'll even send you notifications when you've reached your spending limits. This part I personally love. With over 3 million users and counting, Rocket Money customers have saved an average of $720 a year. So stop wasting time and money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and manage your money the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/understood. That's rocketmoney.com/understood. rocketmoney.com/understood.
State by state, there are small things that are different, but all of them are essentially based on the law that Oregon developed back in 1997. And they all contain the same pretty much 4 requirements. So you have to be an adult. You have to be over 18. You have to be terminally ill. And the definition of terminally ill is that a doctor is guessing that you will die within 6 months without treatment. Mm-hmm. And you have to be mentally competent to make the decision for yourself, and you have to be able to ingest the medication. You have to be able to swallow it is the most common route, but you have to be able to, in some way, do it yourself. And that was a safeguard that was considered important to getting the law passed, so that people wouldn't worry so much about people being coerced into something like this.
And when is the law about living in the state before this takes place?
So there is, in most of the states, there is a residency requirement. The thing is, the first thing I can tell people when they ask, they say, well, I live in Arizona, but, you know, I have a sister in California. Can I move in with my sister? And the answer is absolutely yes. It is, establishing a residency is not difficult. And in fact, we're seeing the beginnings of that particular requirement being tweaked. And in two states, I think already they've removed the residency requirement. There's no longer one in Oregon, and there's no longer one in Vermont.
So people could just travel there to have this particular. Okay, so I have so many questions that go along with this. And I think a lot of people, their main question is, yeah, well, first of all, there's a lot of stigma with this. Is this suicide? Is this right? Is that, you know, ending your life? And there's a lot of, I guess, religious beliefs that go along with that that make it difficult for people. But I think you and I've talked about this. A lot of people that are in the position to make this decision and have been researching this and want to do this are in a different place in life than we are, that we can even comprehend what that's like. What have you come into contact with the people that are reaching out to you? What's their frame of mind when they reach out to you?
Yeah, this has been one of the most amazing parts for me, is to see how people who know they're dying, who are terminally ill, seeing how they think this through, seeing how they deal with this, seeing what they have very little. I mean, they either want it or they know they don't want it. But there's very little waffling about how they feel about it. Their families may have questions, their other people may have questions, but they come at it. I usually say that it's as if they've crossed the line that I haven't crossed, so I can't be 100% in their body, in their shoes, whatever, but that it's something that just seems right and important to them, that gives them comfort, gives them a sense of control in a situation where they don't have a really good choice to make. You know, they have some choices. They can do treatment forever. They can decline all treatment. But when you get right down to it, the bottom line is the same. They're dying, and they have just a few decisions to make, and this is just one of them. That is an option that wasn't there before.
Right. So I think what you're talking about is something that Brittany Maynard made popular, or something that became mainstream news. She was a beautiful girl who had a brain tumor, I believe, and was given 6 months to live. She was terminal, and she decided to document her progress, her process, and the fact that she really wanted to do this. What do you remember from that story?
What I remember is that I could see, for a lot of people that had trouble with the concept of this kind of law, that this lovely girl who had just gotten married and had her whole life ahead of her now had to deal with the reality that she was going to die. Mm-hmm. And I think it humanized it for them in a way that nothing had been able to before. She was articulate. She clearly knew what she wanted. She had a very, you know, she wasn't saying this is for everybody, or yeah. It was very thought through, and it was And the point she made was that she lived in California. And so the point she made was that she wished she could stay home and be in her own home and when she did this, but that was not an option for her. And I think people started to feel like, well, yeah, that's kind of sad. And, you know, gosh, she's got to pack up and go to Oregon to do this. And she did, you know, because it was so public, she did have to, you know, make sure she went through the right steps of establishing residency and so on.
Right. So, Jen, just to clarify, it was because it wasn't legal in California at the time.
Right. Correct. Yeah. Correct. That's correct. And in fact, we credit Brittany Maynard with making a big leap in terms of the California law in particular, but even around the country, how these laws that had been on the books for decades trying to pass, and suddenly they were starting to pass.
Right.
And I think she really had a lot to do with it. And I think for her, it gave her a sense of purpose too. I mean, she really felt strongly about it, and it gave her the end of her life, a real sense of meaning that she could contribute something.
Right. What do you say to those people that are just feel like it's too soon to know when the end is really coming? What do doctors know? Does it always, you know, are they always correct? What about this maintaining hope for recovery?
Yeah. So of course they don't know. And of course people live longer than expected, and some people die sooner. So there's no way around that. It's just, but they can know that it's, that they're dying, if they're dying of cancer or this particular type of brain tumor and so on, that there are certain things they can say. They see signs in the body. They know that this is only headed one place. And, of course, if they do choose to end their life, then they're never going to know. So that's something that the person themselves has to deal with. But usually it's people who sense they're losing their ability to do so much. They're losing their dignity from their point of view. I mean, we all define our own sense of dignity. They've gone from being active, productive people to being bedridden, to being dependent. And they know that even if something happened, they're in pretty
shape. Yeah. And would you say that this is, in some cases, their way to get rid of the pain? Or has the pain been something that you guys and doctors are able to really help make much easier for them at this point in their life? And yes, it's not about relieving pain.
Yeah, I think it's really important to know how many things have changed and improved about death in America. And there have been lots of books about, you know, the sort of death industry and how people get, you know, get their lives extended by all kinds of treatments and things that are quite painful and put them in the hospital in intensive care. You know, if you ask people, if you survey people, and this has been done, most people would describe, you know, if you say, where do you want to die? I want to die at home. You know, what's important to you? It's not being a burden, not being in pain, not being dependent. And even despite that, most people feeling that way, the majority, over 50% of people die in acute care hospitals. And, you know, more than half the people never even have any kind of documentation of what they would want and what their wishes are. Yeah. So now we have hospice. Now we have, in some cases, these medical aid in dying laws. Now we have death doulas and death cafes and different all kinds of things that help people get educated about choices they can make. And there's so much better pain control that if they come in with an image of having seen their grandmother die, and now they think that's going to be me that it's important to educate people also on the alternatives and the options that they have. So this should never be like the first go-to thing. It's just a part of the choices that are available. And the choices, as I said, aren't really most people's, you know, the things they want aren't on the list. Mm-hmm. You know, a longer life of a longer life that has quality.
Yeah.
But when they don't see that, and they don't see, that's when some people start to veer off and say, you know, I think I'm done. I think I've had a good life. I think I don't see these next months adding to my appreciation of my life. And
how many times have you run into that it's harder for the family to deal with, and they're trying to talk the patient out of doing this because of their own, I hate to say the word, but selfish reason?
Well, I'd say actually always harder for the family, because families are the ones that are being left. The families are the ones that really don't want to lose their loved one. So they feel uncomfortable with this concept, and they sometimes feel guilty, like, you know, what could I do? What could I be doing that would change their mind about this? Mm-hmm. But I think also a lot of them have had conversations with their parents and have had their parents, you know, a lot of them say, you know, my mother's been telling me since, you know, I was 21 that she wouldn't want to be kept alive. She doesn't want to die in a hospital. She wants to stay at home. Mm-hmm. And your grandmother was one of them. Mm-hmm. I'm sure she told you, she told us every time we would visit, I do not want to be taken out of my house. I never want to go to a nursing home. Those things aren't usually very appealing for the person who's looking down the road at it.
Right.
But I think that the families come around a lot of the times because when you point out to them that what they're really doing is doing what their loved one wants. You know, this is one way when they say, what can we do? Supporting their husband, supporting their wife, supporting whoever it is that's dying, and hearing what they're saying and trying to help them get what they want is probably the thing that will be most comfort to them afterwards, because they can say, that's what they really wanted. And I swallowed my own feelings about it to give them what they wanted. The other thing is that that's so interesting is how much that support in itself can help the dying person relax, mm-hmm. and sort of think, well, okay, you know, I'm going to get the medication. I'm going to put it in my closet. And if it gets bad enough, I'm set. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of chill out and have some fun, you know? And I think it's about a third of people that get the medication, don't end up taking it. Now, some of that is because they die too quickly or unexpectedly, or they lose the capacity to take the medication. But I think that a chunk of it is that now that they're not in a panic about what if, now that they've got what they need, that then they can just say, well, is it that bad? Or is this kind of okay? And they may start finding things they want to do and say, not yet, not yet. And that's great too. I don't care if people use it or not. You know, if they want it, I'm going to give it to them, but it's never with the idea of, well, if you do this, then you have to take it.
That's a really good point, because I think a lot of people have questions about that. So a doctor has to prescribe it based on the criteria that they have to fall under.
Yes. And all the laws, in fact, two doctors have to be involved. And in some states now, actually, it can be also nurse practitioners and physician assistants. But in most of them right now, it's still two physicians, one who's called the attending physician or the prescribing physician is the main person. They have to be the ones to determine the terminally ill status. They have to be the ones to determine, is the person in their right mind? Do they know what they're talking about? Do they understand what this means? Do they understand the other options that they have? Then there's a second doctor, the consulting doctor, who's just like a second opinion. Okay. They follow up the first doctor by reviewing the records, talking to the patient, and then just signing off saying, I agree.
And do the doctors have to be in the states that it's legal in, or are they just the patient has to take the medicine and the patient in the state that they have to die in or they're allowed to die?
They have to, the physicians have to be in a state where it's legal.
Got it. So now someone is given the okay to get the medication. It's prescribed at a pharmacy. I mean, can they just pick it up at a pharmacy?
Yes. Yes. It's a compounding of five different medications. So it's done at what's called a compounding pharmacy, not, you know, your basic Walgreens or whatever wouldn't have it.
Right.
So that's been another little hurdle that we try to help with, knowing what are the pharmacies that offer it. Mm-hmm. It's expensive. And that's another thing we can talk about is the fact that there's sometimes some cost involved, and that's sort of a barrier.
What is the price point for something like that?
The least expensive pharmacy that I know of in California, it's $450. And the most expensive I've had a pharmacy charge was over $1,000. I'd say the average is around $700 to $800. The thing is that insurance doesn't cover it. Mm-hmm. And insurance doesn't cover it because most of these people have Medicare, and that's federal money. Mm-hmm. And it's like abortion, that you can't use federal money for that purpose because not all the states are on board. Not all the people have voted on this. So if you're in a state that doesn't want that law, they don't want their money going to pay for the medication for something they don't believe in.
Right. So any doctor in, say, California or Oregon can prescribe this medication, but are people finding that there are a lot of doctors that have their own personal beliefs, similar to that of abortion, you know, that they don't want to be involved? And yes. What are people running into with that?
And the law allows for that too, that if you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. If you're a doctor, you don't have to be involved. You don't have to offer this to your patient. And the same with the people involved in hospice care who are taking care of the person at home. If the nurses in that situation don't want to be involved, or as is more often the case, if the hospice makes a decision, they're not going to be involved. They don't have to be. Now, there are ways around that, but it does just create some hurdles. And I think when I think of things, some of it is discomfort with the law. Some of it is religious. Some of it is just doctors, you know, feeling like they're not about death. They're about life, even though on the continuum, life, death is a pretty important part of life. But I remember our governor when the law was passed in California was Jerry Brown, and he was raised a Catholic. Everybody knew he was a Catholic, and he was a kind of a spiritual guy, and he had to sign the law, the legislation into law. And we were all a little nervous, like, would he do it? Because he could have vetoed it. And when he did sign it, as he did, he just gave this lovely speech about how it might not be for him. It might not be a choice he would make for himself, but that he did not think it was right to stand in the way of others to whom it might bring significant comfort and relief. So he just was bigger than, you know, this is bigger than me. And he made that decision.
Right.
And
wow.
I think more, and the other reason on the other side, the other reason that doctors sometimes aren't involved is it's a little more effort. It's takes a little more time. There's some paperwork. They may be afraid of some kind of stigma also. But I think with more time, and that's one of the things we also try to do, if we have doctors who sound like they're sympathetic to the patient that's asked them for the medication, but they just don't know much about it, we will offer to mentor them. We'll team them up with a doctor who's familiar with it, and so that they can learn it and then be comfortable with it. Once they know what they're doing, it's really not that hard. And it certainly can be very rewarding for the ones that do.
Yeah. So let's go back to the details a little bit more. So when you get the medication, how long, what's the expiration life in your closet?
Yeah. You know how much debate there is about what those expiration dates mean? Are they meaningful?
Yeah.
Just like the sell-by dates on your food. So I think we kind of stick to the fact of the expiration date, even though it probably, the medication is so strong, it probably doesn't really have much of an expiration date. But there is one on it, and I think it's a year, at least a year. So,
and something that I find interesting is that patients are actually allowed to do this at home or wherever they want with their loved ones, and a doctor or volunteer does not have to be present, correct? They can literally take charge of when they want to do it.
Mm-hmm. I'd say half the people is the guests who get it have nobody but friends or family with them when they do.
Uh-huh.
And that's both for some people that they like that about it, mm-hmm. but really for a lot of people, they just assume have somebody there who's a little more experienced and to reassure them. Not everybody has been in a room when someone has died. It seems like a kind of a heavy thing to lay on, you know, a wife or a child or a husband. They have to be worried about doing the mixing and the timing and all of this. So again, they're in most of the state.
How would they know if it's going the right way or if they screw it up or, you know, God forbid?
Well, yeah, there's some instructions and that's the pharmacist's job, theoretically, to go through step by step how to do it, how to take it, you know, how long not to have, you know, not to eat a big meal before they do it.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Because you're right. You don't want to throw it up.
Yeah.
And there's some pre-medication actually that is sort of a anti-vomiting medication that you take beforehand. So it's a little bit involved. Some people have relatives or friends that are nurses or doctors, and they volunteer to do it, and that's fine. We have volunteers who are trained, and this is true in most of the states with laws, that you can get a volunteer without costs to do that. You can also get, there's a new field now beyond birth doula, there is now death doula, and they are just people that help walk you through it, pull what you need together. And some of those are for hire, some are volunteer. So you can get someone else to be there. And that's enough.
What would you call yourself? Like, are you a dad?
I just call myself a volunteer for the End of Life Choices California organization. And just tell, you know, they just know that I've been experience, that I know what's up and that I'll take care of it. in the kitchen or whatever, while they can be telling stories and sitting around with the person who's dying.
So I'm curious about your personal experience about it. How often is your phone ringing to be making these dates?
It depends. You know, we're a statewide organization. So one of the things, so every day there's someone on the phone taking calls. I do it about one day a week. But if a call comes from the Bay Area and someone is looking for a volunteer, they've got the meds. All of that went fine, but they've got the meds. They're ready to pick a date. They want to volunteer. Then one of my colleagues who gets that call would call one of the volunteers in the Bay Area and say, "Could you do this?" Mm-hmm. And so it's not a daily happening. So to put it in perspective, less than 1% of all the births, all the deaths that occur in California are due to medical aid and dying. It's a really tiny percentage of people.
Oh, wow.
But of course, all deaths include car accidents and everything. Sorry.
But like to put it into perspective, on a given month, how often would you be doing that?
Yeah, on a given month, a couple of times maybe, or maybe not at all.
Right. Okay.
It's a small number.
And how many people have you been with when they have passed, do you think?
I think in the year and a half, not counting, you know, my previous medical life, mm-hmm. But in the year and a half, I've been a volunteer, actually probably 10.
Wow. Okay. And I'm curious about, has it ever been that you show up for your volunteer duties and you think it's happening that day and they say, you know what, I can't do it, in the 10 times you've done it?
Yeah. You know, that was one of my things at the beginning that I would feel most anxious about. You know, I knew the drill. I knew that I was to go to the bedside, and before handing them the glass, I want to tell them that they can do this or not. Anything is fine. And, you know, they have to say one more time, no, that's what I want. Mm-hmm. And so I asked some of the volunteers that had been involved with this for longer. I've asked at various meetings and conventions, you know, has anybody ever had anybody who just at the last minute said, forget it? And nobody had. Nobody had. Now, I've had people that have changed a date, maybe because someone was flying in from out of town or this or that, or they decided they wanted, you know, to do something one more time. But I've never had, and nor have I heard of anyone who's had someone change their mind at the last minute. And of course, I'm prepared for it. If they said, forget about it, I'd say, great, and go try and find a safe way to dispose of it. Mm-hmm. My instinct is it is that line that I mentioned, that line that they've crossed. While I'm there sort of thinking, are they going to go for it? They're grabbing for the glass. Wow. They're just ready. They talk about being done. They talk about just being done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't want their family to take it personally. There's actually a fair amount of humor here. I mean, these people get so relaxed and I think so relieved that they've made a plan and that they actually sometimes get pretty funny about it. You know, someone who didn't want to do it in the morning because she wasn't a morning person. I mean, it's sweet. It's just, but they're just acting like a regular person and they're really happy and relieved that they can just be this frank about this thing. Yeah. That it's not some horrible, scary thing that nobody can talk about.
Right.
And I sense that even before I meet people on the phone, that it's just something that they've been having trouble talking to their families about or their friends about. They don't know how. It's like certain subjects, politics, and other things. If you don't know how other people feel, you're a little nervous about how to approach the topic. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, they just love it. And they start joking and telling stories. And I don't know. It's just a wonderful...
Can they have a glass of wine right before?
They could. They ask if they can have a chaser, and people have chosen. They choose, you know, we ask them what, you know, do they want a certain soundtrack? Or we've had interesting things there too. You know, someone wanted to watch an old movie, or somebody wanted, you know, the bed moved out into the garden, or someone wanted, and that's all important also. And the family likes that because it gives them little ways to set things up. Mm-hmm. But,
and what is the process of after they drink this concoction, they take their wine chaser, if they so choose, how long do they have left? And what are kind of the signs of how they, I mean, does it seem like they fall asleep? What happened?
Yeah. I'm going to say one thing, which is the chaser normally, which is not alcohol, is something like a popsicle because the medication is quite bitter. Wow. And people do complain about the taste. In fact, one guy, after he drank it, he said, this stuff tastes so bad, it's definitely going to kill me. So, yeah, it's usually a quick popsicle to kind of, you know, numb their mouth a little bit. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there's variation, but pretty standardly within 5 to 10 minutes, they fall asleep. Mm-hmm. And then a little deeper, actually into a coma. Mm-hmm. And then the average is within 2 hours, they have died. It can be longer and it can be quicker, mm-hmm. but that's kind of the normal range. It's about 2 hours.
So they are aware for a few minutes, and then it's almost like taking a sleeping pill. They just kind of peacefully go into sleep.
Correct. Yeah.
Do you think that? Oh wait, let's talk about disposal of the medication too. I mean, do you have to take the whole thing? What if there's some left over? I mean, have you ever run into issues where people abuse it? Because it's in a cabinet for so long. How do you make sure your daughter's not going to get into it, your dog, you know, all sorts of issues.
Exactly. And that's been a topic of conversation. I think the amazing thing is that there are, again, no stories that I know of, no horror stories that anybody can tell. It's just that we all feel anxious about it because that would be terrible. I mean, I get anxious about what if I trip on the rug while I'm carrying the glass, you know, and it spills and right. Then the dog licks it up or, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it has to be taken seriously. And, you know, hospitals have disposal sites for medication. I mean, usually it's the nurse, a hospice nurse, whatever caregiver that person has would be responsible for getting rid of the medication if it wasn't used. Mm-hmm. The medication is so strong that if they start to nod off before they've actually been able to finish it, it doesn't make any difference because it's so much more than they need. Yeah. But it is why we say, you know, you've got 2 minutes to drink down this 2 ounces, which isn't very much, but sometimes we tell them to practice it if they want to. You know, if they're ill and they've been having a little trouble swallowing, they sometimes will practice with water or something to see, and maybe use a straw or something. Mm-hmm. But it can't take forever because if it takes 5 minutes, they'll be falling asleep, and right. Then it's possible that they won't have taken enough. They probably would die anyway, and let us keep in mind they are dying anyway, which adds a little cushion there, you know?
Yeah.
But it could take longer.
Right. What about your thoughts on, you know, so many people will say to me, well, I don't understand why you have to go to one of those states, be part of one of those states. I mean, couldn't you just do it where you are? And I think it's important to talk about the fact that it has to be done legally. In my opinion, I would think just for life insurance purposes. I mean, it cannot be suicide or the life insurance will
correct
out. And I think a lot of people are sort of ignorant to why it's so important to do this in one of the 10 states.
Yes. So the first, you mentioned the first thing, and sometimes families are aware of it and they still think that's why you can't do it. It's that, you know, we won't get our life insurance. Other people, and another interesting one I came up with was, or I heard was, someone didn't want them to do it in their house because they thought it would affect the resale value of their house.
Oh,
you have to apparently disclose if someone's died and
there's a dead body. Yeah,
but then so that led me down a rabbit hole talking to a lot of realtors, and it turns out really not to be an issue. But the reason that and then there's all kinds of stigma besides the issue with insurance to suicide. Nobody wants to think somebody killed themselves. That sounds bad.
Yeah.
So again, it's not suicide because this isn't someone who could live and chooses to die. This is someone who is dying, who chooses their method of death. And so we never use the word. It doesn't, suicide or even medical aid in dying does not appear on the death certificate. It's not written. They die of their underlying disease.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's part of the law. And I think that's a comfort to families. They don't want a death certificate that's advertising whatever.
Yeah.
And the real thing is, and again, we seem to have a lot of, abortion analogies here, but the real thing is that that people who do try to do things on their own, the way women used to feel desperate enough that they would try to abort on their own, and we know where that went. It went with women in some cases dying, but certainly ending up sometimes seriously ill in the hospital. Ruining their fertility for the rest of their life, et cetera. And people who, it's not that easy, as it turns out, to kill yourself in a way that's efficient and quick and not messy for your family and not traumatizing for your family. And the odds are, I don't know what the odds are exactly, but they're pretty good that it won't work, that you'll get something will intervene and instead you'll be in a worse state than you started.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think for the sake of families and for the sake of all those reasons, the fact that it's not very effective.
Yeah.
There isn't a very good way to do it. Sadly. That doing it, that's why we need the law. So it's not underground, it's not sneaky, it accomplishes what it wants to accomplish in the best way possible.
You brought up a couple times the word choice, and I think that's and having the opportunity to make their own decision and also be aware of what they're doing till the very end. And I think that's really important to talk about because, you know, whether or not you agree with this decision or this law, it's not for us to make that decision if it has nothing to do with our bodies, which again is very similar to what you hear when people are talking about abortions. But also, I think it's important for people to realize that the people doing this have to be aware and actually have to drink it themselves, right? Because I think I don't want people to think, oh, my loved one is in hospice right now and I want to think of a way to end their life, then can this just be injected? It doesn't work like that. It has to be something that they choose to do, that they do themselves. And, you know, I'm curious if you think that the laws will be challenged ever in the future, like they're challenging abortion laws.
Yes, they are all the time. And that's why the groups that support this and the one that Brittany Maynard supported and advertised was a national group called Compassion and Choices. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, the main things they do is the legislative side, and they're keeping an eye not just on the states like New York, Massachusetts, ones that are trying again and that we think will be the next ones to get the law, but to be sure that the ones that have the law get to keep it, because they're we've already had at least one challenge to the California law, and we won it, so we kept it. But, you know, absolutely, this is something that people need to be vigilant about, to be sure that it doesn't get removed.
Yeah.
Don't lose it.
So I'm just curious then, you've brought lives into this world and you've been there to see that happen many, many times over the course of 40 years. And then you have been present when people are ending their life. Is there something that is similar? Is there something that is different? Is there something that rings true to you for both of those stages in life?
Well, I mean, they are the bookends, you know, and I think I speak more for what I get out of it than perhaps the families themselves. But by observing this, just it is, I have to think about that. You know, when you bring a baby into the world, there's that whole unknown future ahead of it, that whole expanse that's coming, but you're just there for that one intense moment. Mm-hmm. And I guess when I'm there at the end of someone's life, I've missed all of that, although I love hearing about it. And I usually get engaged in a conversation where, you know, they'll tell me what they did and a little bit about their life and their family and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then it's how it's wrapped up and being able to make it as good as possible coming in and to make it as good as possible going out, mm-hmm. just feels good, feels right somehow. And, you know, medical aid in dying has no monopoly on dignified deaths. I do want to be clear about that, that we could be talking about just end of life and death in general. Mm-hmm. But my ability to be there has more to do with medical aid in dying, because that's what I'm there for.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, there's people make their own, as I said, their own sense of dignity, their own beliefs, all of that plays into it so much. And it's just fascinating and wonderful. It does, in what I've seen, it makes me feel good about the human race after a day of reading the newspaper when I don't feel so good about it.
Yeah. And from what you said, you know, it doesn't have to be, death does not have to be sad and scary and something to really, you know, be, you know, not, it's not like you need to look forward to it, but it can be something that can be peaceful and that you are actually happy in the moment.
Correct. And I think all the more we can talk about it, the more we can explore it, the more we can, you know, it just makes everybody more comfortable with it. And then once it's kind of out there, then it's still sad. There's still the grieving. In fact, I know for a fact that initially there's kind of a euphoria because there's been so much tension and sadness and suffering and so on. And then it's done and you feel so good and you bond around this very intense experience. But of course, then the family members go on and they have to go on without this person that was so important to them. And that's tough. But I still think it's helpful for them to be able to hearken back and to have been part of it. Just like, you know, birth, you used to be women strapped to a stretcher. No one could be with them. You know, it was just and you were in an operating room for the delivery, and
it didn't take chloroform some women to kind of knock them out, or
they gave some very bad medications so that you were really out of it and you didn't remember what happened and you had no control over your behavior. And it was a lonely, I mean, everything, you know, just all went to the, got so medicalized. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with death as well. And I think that just coming back to a place where people have some choices, if they want to try every treatment they can try, if they want to do that chemo one more time, nobody has a problem with that. But people also need to know that that's not a requirement, mm-hmm. and that they could make an intelligent decision for themselves at some point just to say, I think I've done enough. I think I'd rather enjoy my life a little bit, what time I have left, and not spend it in the hospital.
Yeah, right. So now that you know what you know, I guess, and if you feel comfortable answering that, great. If not, I understand. But can you talk about your personal experience? Would you choose to do this? You know, would you choose for your loved ones to do this?
So I'll talk about me for a minute. I have no idea. And I think it's because I'm smart enough to know that I can't imagine yet being in that position. It's like, I was a midwife. I knew all about having babies. When I had a baby, all bets were off. You know, I was like any other laboring woman. And it was like, bing, little light goes off. It's like, okay, there's one thing being smart, you know, understanding it and being able to sort of manage it. And it's another thing being it.
Yeah.
So, but I feel very strongly that I would want to know that that was one of my choices. I would not be happy to think that I didn't have that option if I needed it, because I don't know how I'm going to feel. And I don't know
how bad, and
what is that bad? And, you know, or is it kind of okay? Who was it that said, some famous person, Daniel Ellsberg, who died recently. What a guy. But he apparently was quoted in his obituary that he said he died at home and he had all his friends and family there. And he said goodbye to all his buddies. And he said to his wife, if I'd known dying was going to be so good, I would have done it sooner. Because he was enjoying the, you know, that end. It was just lovely. It was wonderful. He was euphoric. I'm not sure, you know, so maybe it would be like that. And then I wouldn't necessarily think about that. But I think and the other personal thing is we're talking about my husband who has lymphoma. He is terminally ill. He has lived longer than they would have expected. He's the one that worked on the law. And with his first diagnosis, he signed up, he got the meds, and they sat in our closet. But then he improved and improved with some treatment. He wasn't going to take them. He knew he was going to try some treatment. Mm-hmm. And he did, and he had a good response to it. He had a recurrence. We didn't order up the meds this time. Because we did have to get rid of them. They expired. And he would say, one of his expressions is, you know, I'm a person who likes to, when the movie's over, I like to stay for the credits. When I finished my drink, I like to suck the juice from the lime. Mm-hmm. I may want to see this to the very, very end. I don't know. But he knows he can have it. And I think for both of us, that has, that's all we want to know. That's all we need to know at this point.
Right. Well, sorry, that made me cry. I love Bob still. Okay. Well, so if people want more information on this, where could they find it?
You know, do you want me to list the states that have the law? Do you think, I know everybody all over the country listens to your podcast, right?
Yeah.
Well, I wrote them down because I don't have them memorized, but
okay.
So Oregon, Washington State, Montana, Vermont, California, Colorado, Washington, D.C., Hawaii, New Jersey, Maine, and New Mexico. So people in those states, I would recommend you can just look up anything, like if you just put in end of life or end of life act or anything like that, it will pop up your state organizations around your laws. And you should learn, you know, what is the law and how do you get it? And you should have conversations with your doctors about how do you feel about it? And I might be interested in this. Would you be willing to do this? It's never too soon to start chatting about it and finding out about it. In the states that don't have the laws, I know there are at least 12 that are on the books that are trying again. But there's interest in every state, I'll say that. And there are end-of-life organizations in every state. So again, I would just Google end-of-life, end-of-life choices, medical aid in dying, and then put in your state and see what comes up. Because I promise you, every state has mostly, you know, these nonprofit organizations of people who have devoted their life and time to these kinds of issues.
Well, Judith Bishop, thank you so much for being here. I think you answered so many important questions, and all my love to Bob.
Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review if you like what you hear. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or guests that you want us to reach out to? Please email us at infomisunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much, and I can't wait to see you next time.